good to be here. I want to thank, first off, Chris Galen. She was the director at the Rome Art and Community Center at that time and gave me my solo show, particularly for the assemblages, which up until that point in time I had been making but not showing and exhibiting. I'm also a painter, and I have cards that I'll pass out, and you can go onto the website and see that they're really sort of a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality to my art. There are paintings of autumn leaves, which are very marketable and commercial, and then there are these boxes. And, of course, when you venture out into the art world, you'll find that this issue of, am I a commercial artist or am I an artist that's a capital A artist, just interested in the art and not in selling that art or having it purchased. It's always been an issue for me starting out. One of the things that I wish Lisa had stayed to hear was she talked about how in her early years it was extremely formative for her to cut and paste. Well, this is my first assemblage, and it was done at age 14. And I really owe everything to what I learned in schools. And I think I'm a testament, really, to public education providing art classes in high schools. Because my story isn't like the story some of you are here. I assume some of you are students at Munson Williams Pratt, yes? Okay, stay in school, because My career path, I'm going to pass this around. This is actually an example of an assemblage back in the day that my teacher taught me how to do in order to teach elements of design. So initially we had to compartmentalize a box. This is all just mat board, believe it or not, that's been stiffened with some gesso. But then, I know, it was incredible. And then afterwards we would, our assignment was to go and collect like a magpie all sorts of objects. And then we had to arrange them, and so we learned sort of to think three-dimensionally, how to arrange random shapes in space with a pattern or a design in mind. And even back then, I think there was a narrative going on here, which is why I brought this piece. And even if the narrative is somewhat puerile, I mean, drugs are bad. It was called the pill box. There's a hook hanging out of the I know nowadays, we, you know, the older you get, the more you love the pills. But but back in the day, in the 1970s, I mean, I think that was a theme that was not a big reach for a high school freshman. But another issue, too, here is that the entire work has been patinaed, somewhat similar to Louise Nevelson, if you've ever been familiar with her work, her three-dimensional work. She would take various shapes, coat them with a uniform color so that your eyes really went to the relationships of forms rather than what the objects were made of, like my current work. And my current work really harkens more to a gentleman by the name of Joseph Cornell, who worked with objects as they were found, sort of in their pure form, didn't manipulate them at all. So actually it's held up well for those that many years. As I said, stay in school, because my career path is very different. And, you know, I have regrets. I had, in high school, a portfolio. I was ready to go to art school. And I applied, unfortunately, to a few Ivy League schools. And my father was an immigrant to this country. And for him, the fact that his son was able to get into a school of the caliber of, say, Harvard, was an opportunity you just couldn't pass up. And at the time, I was a department recognition or honoree for art. And that's really where I was thinking I was going to go. And I sort of talked to my friends and teachers, but came up with the decision on my own. I really felt that as an artist, you need to experience life. I was really learning a lot of techniques, but I had no voice. I had no content. I had nothing to say. And I thought, okay, go out first, get a great education, then come back and you'll have something to say with the talents God gave you. And actually, that's really how it happened. Because from the day I left high school and graduated, 1977 to 1997, till I returned home, I never painted, drew, sculpted, did anything. And it was really coming home and taking care of my mom and my sister that I had this free time. And, of course, your thoughts go back to, you know, what was in your comfort zone? What did you do with your free time? I mean, when you're working, as Lisa said, when you're working, you have very little time to be an artist. And so you always regret that. Well, now I had the free time. And what do you do? Where do you start again? And getting back into this career is particularly difficult because, like any career, career artists have sort of made it their domain or province. So breaking back in to this field and calling yourself a professional artist after you've done X, Y, and Z and not attended and gotten an MFA is very difficult because they don't take you seriously. You're a Sunday afternoon painter. You're not necessarily somebody who is recognized as an artist per se because you didn't pursue that vocation from, you know, day one. I mean, there's something to be said for it. I feel that my work is growing, that I'm continually outdoing the prior year's output. I understand now when I listen to other artists talk about their work that there is this progression and sophistication, and I see the need for having these sorts of talks because we really need to communicate where we're going, because down the line I'll probably be putting out stuff that you'll be looking at and going, what is he thinking? I can explain these, I think. But I know that right now in my current work, I'm moving in directions that are, like Lisa, I'm less comfortable nailing it down for you. And I think that's probably a tendency among all artists as they progress in age and develop their styles. Now, in school, in Harvard, I wrote a thesis, which I brought. And the thesis was very well received, and it took a lot of time. It was a year's worth of a labor of love. And it was based on a pamphlet printed in Germany at the time of the Reformation called Das Passional Christi und Antichristi. And it was written, or drawn, I should say, by Lucas Cranach the Elder. It was printed in 1520, at the time of the Reformation, when no German knew German enough to read it when they saw it in print. And Luther needed to convince the populace that the Pope was the Antichrist. And what he resorted to was not Latin or even German. He resorted to an artist to produce images to convey that message. And he did so with a very famous, at that time, Renaissance artist, Lucas Cranach. And what Lucas Cranach did, which was really extraordinary, was in a series of 13 paired woodcuts, show you the life of Christ, scenes from the life of Christ, contrasting with scenes from the life of the Pope. And what's brilliant about this was he didn't really have to portray the Pope with the papal tiara and Christ with the crown of thorns. It was almost the actual visual. You could see the disparity or the inversion that was occurring. Here we have Christ being crowned with the crown of thorns. Here you have the Pope being crowned with the papal tiara. How inverted was that? Other scenes show the Pope being carted through the streets of Rome. And the opposite image for Christ? He's carrying the crucifix through the streets of Jerusalem. Think about the images that reverses and puts into the heads of common people who at that point really didn't understand the sophisticated nuance of theology. And so this really is the start of modern-day propaganda, in a sense, but also had a very important impact on the visual arts because artists learned that visuals could convey important messages. And so when we talk about art possessing the capability of having narrative and that it's always there, I mean, this is an example of how I sort of stumbled onto it in my studies, and it really remained one of the hallmarks of my later work. I am always thinking in these terms. In fact, in a lot of my images and in a lot of the ways I position things, I frequently enjoy placing items in antitheses. That is to say, I delight if I am going through a junk shop and I find two of the same figurine, because I'll position them sort of one facing front and the other reversed, because there's the pattern, there's the totality that I see. In any event, when I came home, my first boxes were a return to the box that I started passing around. And it were the issue was that, instead of manufacturing these boxes out of, say, the Mac board, what I tried to do was just go out and find discarded boxes and then jerry-rig a system of shelving units. And after I did that for a while, I started noticing that in some of these works, the story that I was trying to say leapt out of the entire scene. It almost felt like it was a distraction putting them in various boxes, that I really needed just one stage to set the picture moving. And so I started working with boxes that were just a single opening and arranging the items there and using the patina. And the last work I did, which was called, in that manner, The Frog Prince, I had really found some delightful objects, and the patina actually, how should I say, the coarseness of the surface exterior got in the way of the narrative. It was a struggle to recognize what it was you were looking at. And I started to think about leaving the patina behind. But that's a very difficult issue because you're looking at pure form when you have a patina over over objects. And your eye tends to then appreciate things it doesn't otherwise see. When you start putting just found objects into boxes, people's first reaction are, oh, that's a clothespin. Oh, that's a shoe. Right? And you have to start worrying that what the objects are starts either contributing or detracting from your message. And as well, you have to consider the overall aesthetic look of the item. If you're thinking that you can sort of go out into a trash pile, pull together a few pieces, plop them into a box, and voila, you have a finished work of art, you're kidding yourself. Because what the assemblage artist won't tell you is that always with sleight of hand, you were going back into your object, and looking at things, and repainting and covering certain aspects to make for a more harmonious whole. What you don't realize is that that shoe had been entirely repainted with actual shoe polish, and I had to really think about what was the color that was going to work. This gold figurine wasn't really that color gold. That actually comes from a bowling trophy. That's a female bowler. But her arm is broken. I love using broken items when I find them. A broken item excites me more than, you know, a completely perfect or intact piece. But in this case, the brassiness of the finish really bothered my eye, and I had to go back in and figure, okay, how can I deaden or oxidize that surface? This rusted piece of metal is perhaps the only thing that I found as is. But what was interesting in Lisa's talk was she's, you know, saying, oh, I'm only a 2D artist. And I think, you know, there's a very fine line there. I had a couple artist friends at the time that these were manufactured who were trying to help me. And one of the artists was a watercolor artist, and she came back with this piece of metal. And the other artist who had accompanied her on this search laughed. And when he handed me the pieces, he said, Lucy, you know, she just doesn't get it. And I looked at that piece of metal, this flat piece of metal, and I laughed along with him. I said, you know, she doesn't understand the three-dimensional nature of what I'm doing, odd, peculiar shapes. But I went home and I stared at that piece of metal. And this really, for me, was sort of a very seminal work of art, because it's called Thinking Inside the Box. If you're going to take two dimensions as your constraint and a box as your constraint, can we portray that in the third dimension? Because I often feel that, you know, freedom starts by recognizing you're all in cages. And you only really begin to create when you recognize and perceive that there are certain limitations that are set forth, period. Canvases all have edges, right? Photographs, they've got a distinct beginning and end. You can't keep creating beyond those boundaries. So when you accept those limitations, what can you make of that? So I kept staring at this two-dimensional piece of rusted metal, and the more I looked at it, the more I saw Roscoe. And there's an image, I mean, it looks like from Buffalo's Albright Knox, the image of orange and red that hangs, that I had seen as a child. And I was really, that was the sort of epiphany for me to start this box. I then placed that figure behind him because it's really the issue of an individual like ourselves in three dimensions breaking through that two-dimensional barrier inside a three-dimensional object. And the tiles, I mean, this is kind of interesting for me because there's been a lot of talk about process. And I think assemblage art really is about process. You do not start out from the get-go with any idea or preconception in mind of where you're going. But unlike Lisa, I mean, I do have a collection of junk. And you know, soon I will be featured on A&E's Hoarders. But, you know, occasionally in the process of making these works, and this one in particular, I was wandering around by my house and I looked down at my feet and in the mud was that little white tile. And I happened to know that I had a collection of green tiles in the back of my mind. And again, my mind flashed on the image of Rothko with his large flat planes of color. And I thought placing one in front of the other would be exactly what I needed to sort of give this a two-dimensional yet three-dimensional shift. And unfortunately, the way the light's showing, you're not really seeing, but that green is really a translucent, bright, vivid green tile in the background. So it's almost as bright as the white tile if a light was shining horizontally into the interior. So it's hard to really describe the creation of this. These were all done in one piece. Somebody asked, you know, what was the time frame? I was working towards that show, Thinking Inside the Box. But like Lisa, I've moved on. I've done a subsequent show in January that dealt with a whole series of new boxes. They're in this vein, although again, some of the pieces, you wouldn't suspect it to look at them, but some of the pieces have been altered. I do find that when I think about the creation of anything, the narrative comes to me not during the creation, but almost there is a certain point. I want to say it's two-thirds or three-quarters of the way when I'm almost there. Lisa says she puts her stuff, maybe a piece on a piece of fabric, and puts it away for a month. This turned piece of wood was sitting in that box for probably 6 months. And you come back to these things, and suddenly something clicks. And for me, it was my background in comparative religion, and I sort of had this little brass fitting, and I had this little piece of walnut shell, and I started looking at that shell, and I said, that's an amazing interior space. I mean, what nature has created there is just amazing. And placing them together, I said, oh my God, it's a reliquary. And after that, the entire shape took place. And I really liked the idea, as in most reliquaries, it's usually something really gross like, you know, a bone fragment, a toe, a piece of ear, you know, and then it's all dolled up beautifully around it. I've used very common items, household items. There's a zipper and the clothespins, the anti-clothespins, and the brass outfittings. This little piece of fabric actually came from a 1950s stereo. I never throw anything out, but a stereo speaker from the 1950s had some really high-end fabric in it. And I've later used the actual plastic covering of that in another box later. One thing I can tell you as an assemblage artist that's very, very true, you never know what's going to be useful. You don't want to throw a single thing away. And I feel badly for the people on those shows like A&E's Hoarders, because if you've watched that, every single one of them, as they've got that psychotherapist saying, now, you don't really, you know, you don't want to keep this. But that person can tell them where they bought it, where it came from. And I sort of have that same ability that, you know, the pieces accumulate in my garage and in boxes in my house, and I have a good memory of those. And I can tell you that in the creation of many of these works, I remember those pieces that I haven't thought about in years. And so when you describe sort of the creation of a work of art, it's a matter of, you know, the years that you spend collecting it, remembering it, thinking about it, processing it, and then something in the collection of items that you assemble calls out for that piece. And you remember it, you go and get it, and it's like the missing puzzle piece a lot of times. So there is a great deal of mystery to this. And I started out this talk by telling you I was a painter only because for me, there's this fascinating comparison between the way I paint and the way I assemble. And I would at some point love to sit down with psychologists and talk about the various ways that there are to be creative, because painting for me is so, you know, I have an image that I want to reproduce, and I know whether it reaches that ideal that I'm looking for or it doesn't. It's either a success or it's not. That's not at all what happens here. I find these boxes in the trash. I come home and I play around. Sometimes pieces fit, like that shoe just happened to fit, but the shoe stayed in that box, like that turn piece of wood stayed in that box for some time. There wasn't an idea of what that was going to turn into. And I can remember in this particular case, you know, this was La Strada, so I'm not even quoting from Shakespeare. I'm quoting from popular culture. Fellini, they showed the movie here, I'm sure. I can tell you when I saw that, I mean, that was one of the most powerful, and I mean, I had tears in my eyes at the end of that movie. It's such a great film. And, but again, you know, was I thinking of it when I saw that shoe, when I found that box? Absolutely not. For me, what happened was really the face. The face, I was working with that heel, and for some reason I thought a face would look good on it. And I have a lot of books like Lisa does that I use to cut out whatever figures, pictures of people. And that face seemed to just fit perfectly, that area of the heel. And the minute that came about, I started thinking of La Strada because of the shoe and walking in the street. And again, outside, I happened to cross this chain that was rusted lying on the dirt, and I brought that home and layered it around the box. The scary thing, I suppose, about any of these creations is that, you know, again, it's totally beyond my control. I went on the internet. This is the only time I'll tell you about this kind of cheating. I went on the internet because I said, in La Strada, the woman, the young lady, plays a trumpet to attract the crowd. The strong man breaks chains. But the young woman, she attracts the crowd to his display of strength by playing the trumpet. And for her, that's a release because she's an orphan. And so I needed a trumpet. And I needed one about that size. And what are you going to do? And I mean, in years of hoarding, I'd never come across one. But I went on the internet and actually, luckily, within about three clicks, found exactly what I wanted. They mailed it to me. I sent them back a picture because I said, doesn't it look great? Because they sent me this beautiful, shiny trumpet. And there was about 2 days of work aging and rusting that thing so that it really looked old. But, you know, there was this missing piece up here. And for me, the movie is about that, the destruction, the brutality of innocence and art, that the strong man that takes this orphan girl in and sort of abuses her in the process and then casts her to the side of the road and later regrets his decision and goes back looking for her only to discover that she's dead and then weeps by the seashore with the stars twinkling in the distance because he realizes, you know, he'll never get that back again. And for me, I needed that contrast between the trumpet and the broken dreams that that trumpet represented. And damn it, if walking down the street, that caught my eye, that piece of metal. I still don't know what it is. But if you look at it and you look at the lines in that trumpet, it was meant to go together because it looks like the shoe stepped on the trumpet and created that rusted piece of metal. Now, the fact that that's happening in the weak amount of time that I'm putting these things together has to really give you pause for thought. It does me, because I'm not in control of that. I couldn't, even if I wanted to, have gone onto the internet to find that particular piece or object anywhere. I didn't even know really what I was looking for at the time. So, in a sense, when you're creating, and I think my friends could really tell you about this, you're 24/7 creating. There's a sensibility, a nervous excitation almost, that anything you come across in your daily life could be that missing piece. And so the problem with box building, as probably with any passion that you have, you burn out. I usually do these in periods of months, and after 2 months I really have to go into a period of collecting, hoarding, thinking, and then back to the drawing board of creating. I'd be interested in, if you had any questions about particular associations you have with any of these boxes. I don't know if any of you have listened to the recording, but I mean, I do have narratives that sort of tell me what's going on in these boxes, but I'm fascinated because I'm always intrigued that other people bring such different interpretations to the work. I mean, for example, Estrada, I mean, I try to give you those clues that it's the Fellini film that I'm talking about there, but I wonder, somebody who's never seen the film, what would they make of that? Or where would they even begin? Yes. Yep.
And that's what came to my mind when I looked at that. It's, you know, the trumpet and the shoe and you know, the downtrodden people trying to build themselves up again. And that's, you know, that's what came to my mind.
There is that sense. I mean, you really have to respect sort of what the object you're working with brings to the piece. I mean, that shoe, when I had it, I mean, if you handle it like it's a gift, because, I mean, who knows how many shoes were made off of that mold. And what I did to it was sort of this worn, bleached out wood, and I wanted to give it a certain richness and vibrancy, kind of put the blood back into it, if you will. And so that brown for me, I really tested a couple of different stains to get a rich, earthy, red-brown tone to the shoe. And then you had the metal, and that metal's been retouched with paint that has micaceous iron oxide, so it actually gives a bit of a glitter to it in the silver. So, and then that's where I riffed off the stars, because the stars came from me seeing those small, I don't know what to call them, they're not really nails, but that's what they seem to me to be, stars. And so I went and had to find, I mean, you go and you look for, when you're looking for something that specific, you end up usually finding about 20 different variants. You buy anything star-shaped, you bring it back, and you're like, no, 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 and until you find something that's a yes. I want to hand out something before I finish, which is why we really belong together on the same wall. This is a short story by Donald Barthelme. It's called Conversations with Goethe. Goethe had an amanuensis, sort of a secretary, who would write letters, and Goethe was very well known for his sayings. And the secretary's responsibility was to capture this brilliance. And these are very short and terse, but very dry and very amusing aphorisms collected after the manner of Goethe. So this is entirely fictional, but why I'm giving you this is because, for me, when you do artwork that's small and contained and yet somehow is the same idea, it's a small box, what do I put into it? A different story. And that's what this gentleman has done in a setting. And I think sometimes small is more powerful than large. I mean, it would be easy for me to take what's on inside my box and translate it to a room. But I don't want to be an installation artist. And there's something about the ability to sort of control and manipulate a very small, condensed, and what's the word, deep? A microcosm that's more attractive to me. So I take this home and read it, because it's, sure, they're very, very funny. Don't I wish?
Okay.
I was thinking of giving him one.
Well, I look over in the library, and there's a box over there, construction over there, with compartments that made me think of yours. But I'm not sure.
There's Luke Samaras.
No.
He's modern. No. But if you have a Cornell. Oh, it is Jim Ridlon. Okay, can I tell you a good story? I have a good story about Jim. Jim Ridlon is the husband of the reviewer who panned the show. Okay. Yes, the Uneven Munson Show. The review in the Syracuse paper was written by his wife. And, yeah. But when I was a student in Mr. D'Angelo's class making that box, Jim Ridlon came to our classroom. And at the Limestone Gallery 2020 Small Work Show, where I had these works, he and his wife, the reviewer, came up and looked. And, of course, I'm over in the corner gushing and going, oh, my God, it's Ritalin. And I went up to him and met him, and I think that was the faux pas that I said, I was only this high when you came to see my class. And it reminded him of his age. And but he is really in the 70s, one of the, I know, but, you know, the things you say.
Make somebody kind of show being reminded of their age.
Absolutely. Some people get a little nervous of it. I think, you know, the older you get, the better you get, period.
I think so, too.
Yep.
Can you just address a little bit, how do you know when you're finished?
You're asking great questions. Just the other day, a box that I finished in December, in fact, if you noted, well, you can't see them on this. Back in the day, they would glue these things shut, and then you were finished, okay? There was no getting back into them. And what I've done is I figured out a way to use hook eyes and screws so that the box frames are attached, but I can get back inside. And that's particularly helpful in case something were to break. But the issue here for me is, of course, also when is finished? And there was a piece that was done, and something bothered me about it. There was this gap at the base of a sculpture that just was a space that I couldn't deal with. But I didn't have a piece for it. And I ran into that piece recently, and I went back in, and I had no compunction, even though it's been documented, photographed, and so forth, and I'd like to send it out to shows. I doubt anybody's going to notice that piece except me. But there are frequently times when I will go back in and say, you know, that needs to be added. It is, however, a minor detail. The entire overall image is really done. For example, I guess with sight gag, I mean, when is done? For me, the bottle, the figurine, that strange headdress of a stereo on her head, I mean, that was the core. The issue became then, for me, it was initially entitled Der Spaziergang, which means the walk, the promenade, because she's walking off the edge of the bottle. And I was sort of riffing on, again, Bosch a little bit in terms of the figure. But the sight gag came to me because, you know, when people get drunk at cocktail parties, they'll put the lampshade on their head and walk around and think that's a hoot. And I loved the word, sight gag. Because gag can mean both, it's a joke, but it can also mean a binding. And that object is binding her sight over her head, which is why I inserted the negative in the back of the box. And then I stood back and looked at it, and there was something missing from the foreground, and that took a lot of time, because I didn't want something that would really detract from the element and that figure walking off the precipice of the glass bottle. And in looking at it, again, the lighting isn't that great here, but there's this very curlicue structure to that gramophone, to the headpiece, that riffed for me off of the spiral. And then several days later, like you're saying, you know, when's finished, I added that penny. But it's not just any penny, it's an Austrian pfennig. And for me, I mean, again, it was this whole idea of the walk, Der Spaziergang. I wanted to use something that was Germanic. And an American penny would have been too big, so that's how it ended up. But, yeah, I mean, they sort of evolve. An interesting story about that is that brass bolt, initially the way that gramophone was going to be positioned in the box was going to use that brass bolt against the back wall, so it was going to loom out at you, and she was going to be proceeding forward. But then it got rearranged, and I thought, oh, God, now I've glued that brass bolt on the back of it. But if you look at it, what I did was I colored it so that it matched her coloration, the brass coloration, and your eye sort of goes up, and it compositionally is nicer to have that there than to have just that object be brass alone without another brass object inside. Good question. It's usually a box-shaped form that you'll see in Catholic churches around the 15, 1600s. They would have pieces of the saints, say a piece of the cross, or supposedly a piece of the cross, and that was such a precious item that they would encase it. And the way they would encase it wasn't just any ordinary box. It would be a box within a box within a box. So satins and gems and everything would adorn this thing, and you'd look at it, and it would be something really gross, like I said, like, you know, the tiny toe of Saint Antigone, okay? Well, thanks again for listening. It's been a pleasure.